one of the things I get asked all the time is why haven't I lost my hair? But it has thinned out a lot. And what was quite weird was while it seemed to drop off my head, it was kind of like a balding man. You know how bald men start growing facial hair?
So it fell off your head and grew on your face.
Yeah. Like even the kids noticed it and they were laughing, saying that I was growing a beard faster than my son. I've got stage 4 bowel cancer. We're going to talk about everything from my diagnosis to treatment and how things are going right now. Talk about the things that people might be curious or want to hear but are too frightened to ask.
That's Jo Mackenzie McLean and I'm Colleen O'Hanlon. We've been mates and colleagues at Stuff for 20 years. Since her diagnosis, Jo's been incredibly open about her illness on social media, and in this podcast, she wants to go further.
So I'm just hoping that what we do here can just help people who are on that journey, whether they've got cancer or not, and make them feel that, you know, that they're not alone.
I'm going to be with Jo every step of the way. There will be tears and laughter. She'll also offer practical insights, support and hope. This then is the story of Jo versus cancer. Jo, last time we talked about your first meeting with your oncologist and the cost of buying the drugs you need, and your treatment plan also included chemotherapy, am I right?
Yes.
So can you tell me about that in terms of the process, you know, maybe what surprised you about it, you know, the side effects you were warned about, the ones that you really felt the most, you know, because I guess, you know, there's the chemotherapy itself, right, and then there's that ripple effect of other ways in which it impacts your life.
Yeah, so I guess one of the things that I didn't understand was the amount of different chemotherapy drugs available and all of the different side effects that each of those drugs could potentially bring. And, you know, I guess initially I thought chemotherapy meant I automatically, like a lot of people probably think chemotherapy, I'm potentially going to lose my hair. That was one of the side effects that I thought, you know, would be an immediate
outcome,
yeah. And so anyway, also I didn't realise that chemotherapy could come in forms like pills and also through my PIC line.
Yep. So your port on your chest, you mean?
Yeah. Yep. So they pump it in through that. And that can take anywhere between 2 hours to, I was there the other day for 8.5 hours. So just depends on the different combination of drugs that you're getting.
So the day to day of chemotherapy can look like what? Like you have a cocktail of drugs that you take at an appointed time, or you have a hospital appointment. You know, you turn up every 2 weeks. I know you've talked about going to Dunedin Hospital every couple of weeks. So what is a normal, you know, like, you know, chemotherapy regime look like for you?
At the moment, it's going to Dunedin every 2 weeks and getting drugs pumped into my portacath, sitting there for several hours while that's done, and then
is that an uncomfortable, you know, like apart from the discomfort of the portacath, which I can imagine is not insignificant, but is it, you know, what are you doing in that time? 8.5 hours, for example, is a long time. Are you resting? Are you, you know, is your mum or your partner with you? How do you pass that time?
Yeah, right. So usually there's probably 3 other people in the room with me.
Mm-hmm. That's 3 other cancer patients?
Cancer patients. And I've either got my mum or it's usually my stepdad or my partner, because my stepdad drives me there. So it's either him or my partner. And they sit beside me and I get in there, and the previous day I've had the meeting with Chris Jackson and discussed, you know, done the weigh-in and gone through the blood tests, and they do all the other things, and then they basically lie you down and jab a needle, yep, into your chest and start administering it. And generally what I've done is asked for the menu.
Yep.
Because there's quite a nice menu. I haven't really lost much. I have sometimes lost my appetite, but there's a bit of a running joke that the kitchen knows that I'm coming.
Yeah. That's good though, right? And the nausea, I guess, can be a side effect.
Yeah, and it does, you know, it has affected my appetite. And but yeah, so usually they come over with a pen and paper and take my order. And because of the chairs are quite sticky, so now when I walk in, they
like vinyl. Or...
Yeah, yeah. And so I've been a little bit of a precious patient, and I've sort of asked for a sheet on the chair and some pillows and a blanket. So when I come in now, the nurses automatically just go to the cupboard and bring me the gear.
I don't know that it's precious to make yourself comfortable during, you know, what's a difficult kind of. Procedure, for want of a better word, yeah. I suppose. So I don't think that's difficult. Asking for a blankie and a sheet isn't too much, I don't think, Joe.
And a wee electric heating blankie too. Yeah, I usually
love
get one of those.
I do love those.
I actually went and bought one. And then I kind of, I like just to talk to the nurses. There's quite bad cell phone reception. I always take a book and something to do, but I never end up reading it because I'm sort of curious about what's going on.
Yep.
And I think because I'm a reporter by nature, you know, like I'm just generally kind of inquisitive about what's going around around me, yeah. What's going on around
your
me.
Your antennae are always up, right, for
yes.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm watching and I'm looking at who's around me and I'm like, where are the other young people? Because most of the time, the people who have been in the room with me are elderly.
Right.
And a lot of the time, I'm kind of like a kid in the corner wanting to talk to people and they don't want to talk. No one talks to me.
Right.
Very rarely.
Oh, that was actually going to be my next question around, you know, when you go back, is it the same people? You know, do you, in your various appointments, have you met people who are on their own cancer journey or is it just like a, you know, revolving door of people who need treatment?
Yeah, mostly. Sometimes you see familiar faces over a couple of different rounds and then that changes. One time I went there, there was a man there who Michael, my partner and I actually know from Wanaka, him and his wife, and we had quite a few appointments that clashed because they were coming in from Wanaka too, so they obviously had their appointment with Chris on a Monday. He runs his private clinics on a Monday, then the treatment is
Tuesday.
Usually Tuesday, and that was really lovely because we had lots in common and we've kept in touch. I didn't know them that well, but we've kept in touch and shared some therapies. Like, for example, he gets really bad ulcers in his mouth and he showed me this manuka honey, really expensive manuka honey that he rubs into his mouth. So he's like, Joe, have you tried this? He's an older kind of farmer guy and who does shooting with Michael. And so, you know, his wife, they've come to visit me. She's visited me. And so
that
was lovely. So I really missed having them there when I, you know.
The treatment plans didn't align anymore.
Yeah. So I really missed that company because I find sitting there, sometimes it can be quite, not lonely, but it would be nice to talk to other people and know what kind of cancer they've got, I guess, and how they're finding treatment. I remember one lady at the start, this older lady, and she said to me, you know, that she was meant to be gone like 6 years ago. So she said, you know, there's lots of treatments out there. That was when I first started going to
That's probably what you needed to hear.
She was lovely and, yeah, and I was like, that is really reassuring, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but a lot of the time people just want to get in there, get the treatment and leave, and some of them are really sick and just look like...
And maybe not feeling conversational.
Yeah, they're not like... they just look really tired and sick. And some days I go there and more recently and I've been like that. So I can totally appreciate that. Yeah. That's fine. So
one thing I've often wondered about people who have ongoing treatment, whether for cancer or for another, you know, condition or disease, but is, you know, does it become easier to undergo treatment, like, you know, having needles stuck in you or whatever the case might be, or actually is the opposite true, that the more it happens, the more uncomfortable it becomes, the more you resent it. You know what I mean? Like, is it kind of like, for me, I hate blood tests. The older I get, the more I have, the harder they get. Is it the same when you have a lot of treatment that actually, you know, your resistance to it is less, or do you develop more of it?
I think that, you know, I've lost count of how many scans and stuff and blood tests I've had. So I think I've got used to that. But there are days that I sort of lug myself to the doctor's surgery to get the blood tests, and, you know, the nurse comes to get me, and she's, how are you? And I'm like, burst out in tears, and I'm just
over it. Sick of being poked and prodded.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, I'm tired. My body's tired. Yeah, and it's just, I'm over it.
Yeah.
And the problem is I don't have any light at the end of the tunnel at this point.
To keep going with it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, this is what my foreseeable future looks like. So I just have to, I can't change it. I just have to keep going to the appointments and just keep hoping that, you know, the drugs are working, and just suck it up, basically. But there's days that getting that chemo, getting the injection is a lot easier, but my mood can definitely be flatter some days, and I'm I need a bit of a propping up. But
all right, so you travel to Dunedin from Cromwell in order to get chemotherapy. Can you tell me a bit about the logistics of your treatment? You know, how long does it take? Who pays for the transport? Where do you stay? You know, what the obligations are of, you know, I guess your support network in terms of getting to treatment?
So my stepdad, he sometimes takes me, and he has to take time off work to drive me to Dunedin. Generally, I either have to go on a Sunday night or to make my Monday appointment with Chris. And then my chemotherapy treatment is either on the Monday if it fits, or Tuesday. So I'm usually staying overnight, at least one night. And if it's not my stepdad, my partner drives up from Invercargill. He has to take time off work. He drives up to me, and then we drive across to Dunedin. It's a 3-hour drive from where I live. So thankfully, I've got an auntie. My auntie lives around the corner from Mercy Hospital, so we stay with her. So I'm very, very lucky, because otherwise we'd have to be paying for accommodation.
As well as transport.
Yeah, as well as transport.
And time off work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And how often is that? Every
2 weeks.
Yeah, okay. It's not an insignificant financial impact.
I think my partner worked out it's about 10 grand a year.
Yeah. Not many New Zealanders have a spare 10 grand up their sleeve.
And also to take time off work.
Yeah.
You know, and to have someone that can drive me. Plus, I can't drive myself because it just wouldn't be safe.
And driving home. Like, you know, and the other thing is, you know, what's that journey like for you coming home, having had, do you feel shit after that trip?
Yeah, sometimes, depending on the drug. There's one drug that I take, I'm back on it now, and it affects your, can give you neuropathy, like pain in your hands and feet and stuff. And also, if you suck in cold air, it feels like you can't breathe and you're choking. So you've got to wrap yourself up. And also, you're really tired, and also you're, might have been given steroids, your moods are really up and down. It's exhausting. Mm. And, you know, sometimes I'm achy, sometimes I'm sweaty, sometimes I'm
grumpy,
emotional. Yeah, sometimes I'm grumpy. Yeah. Mm. There's no way I could drive myself to those appointments.
It really just illustrates to me that, you know, and I know you're acutely aware of this, but you've got a fantastic support network, and you've got in your life the privilege of having friends and family and the community members who are able, for example, take time off work to be able to come. But, you know, it does make me wonder about those people who are maybe in their own cancer fight who are doing it alone or don't have or can't travel to treatment, because I guess that's a harsh reality in our country with a dispersed population, right?
Yes, yeah, especially in rural communities. Mm. If I was in lived in Dunedin or lived in Christchurch, it would look a lot differently.
Mm. I know your treatment plan has changed as you've moved along your cancer journey, Joe, but can you talk a bit about the side effects? Because I think maybe our listeners might know about some of the obvious ones, but I'm sure there are plenty that are unique to different individuals.
So one of the things I get asked all the time is, why haven't I lost my hair? And that is all to do with the drugs that I'm on. My hair has thinned out. Luckily, I've had a really big thick of hair, head of hair all my life, so I don't know whether that's...
You had heaps to spare.
I had some to spare, yeah. So, but it has thinned out a lot. And what was quite weird was while it seemed to drop off my head, it was kind of like a balding man. You know how bald men start growing facial hair?
So it fell off your head and grew on your face.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah. So, yeah, my kids started to notice this kind of thick hair on my...
Peach fuzz.
Yeah. That's a nice way to describe it. And, yeah. Actually, I didn't realise it was that bad until I went to the beautician and I wanted to get my eyebrows tinted. I had something on and they were really thin and I just wanted to get made a little bit prettier, you know. Yeah. So I got my...
Don't we all the time?
So she tidied those up and then I was lying there with my eyes shut and I felt her hands kind of go over my eyebrows and then they kind of went down. And she was kind of went... would you like me to get rid of these hairs along your chin as well and your cheek?
Your jawline.
And I was like, pardon? She goes, there's quite a downy, hairy area down here that I think we could definitely do with waxing off.
Yep.
And her hand kind of kept going towards my chin and she's like, and down there and then down my neck. And, yep, so she ended up giving me what I felt like was some sort of manscape, like because she ended up doing my whole facial area.
But I think that because you're quite fair, I think that might have been coming at you anyway, given age and stage of life and whatnot. So it might have been your introduction to it. But because you're quite fair, you maybe haven't noticed it when you were younger.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know. But it definitely seemed like even the kids noticed it and they were laughing, saying that I was growing a beard faster than my son. They were having a competition who was going
facial hair faster.
Yeah, my 12-year-old son or me. And they were like, you're winning, Mum. And they were pulling it out and like stroking it. And it was quite fluffy and soft.
And so is that an ongoing treatment? Is that now part of your ongoing treatment plan?
Well, I've recently had a manscaping wax, but my drugs have changed since then. So another one of my drugs actually gave me quite thick eyelashes.
Bonus.
Yeah, that was a bonus, but that's changed again now. And everyone's like, oh, look at your eyes. They look so good. And I was like, yeah, well, that'll probably only last about 6 weeks and then they're all going to fall out. So it's a short-lived kind of thing.
Yeah, but Take your wins where you get them, Joe.
Well, you know, I hardly ever have to like worry about shaving my legs or anything because the hair doesn't grow down around there now either. So that's a bit of a cost saving.
That's an upside I never saw coming, but anyway.
But I have talked to friends about my hairy face thing and gone, oh my God. And a lot of them kind of just what you sort of said before was like, so what? Like, we've got hairy faces. We've been waxing for years, you know. So
that's what I mean. Like, I know people have been waxing their face since they're in their 20s for, you know, hormone-related reasons or whatever. Mm. But I think it's, you know, being fair, you've dodged that bullet till later in life, I think.
Well, one of the side effects as well from drugs, it can throw your body into a menopausal state.
Right.
So they call it chemopause. And I've definitely had that because quite often there'll be nights where I am sweating, I have hot flushes, I'm thrashing the blankets off and, you know, and I feel bad for taking the mickey out of Mum so much when she was going through menopause because, you know, it is pretty horrendous.
And it's not a short thing, you know, either. Like I think I remember reading somewhere that menopause on average, or menopause can be a decade worth of transition. It's not like you go through a rough 6 months, you know, it can be really brutal for a long period of time, right?
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes, I'm a bit unsure about what is the cancer drug, what is my normal body. Just like a normal, I'm 44, so what my body is doing naturally itself, like as you said earlier.
Versus what's being brought on by the treatment.
Yeah.
It's a lot, Joe. There's a lot. It's a lot to be.
That's just a little bit. I mean, there's other side effects too, like I was on steroids, quite high doses of steroids because I'm also grappling with a rheumatoid arthritis and so we're juggling between inflammation.
And is that not cancer related? Is it cancer aggravated? Don't know.
We're kind of not too sure. So I had the diagnosis of the arthritis before my cancer diagnosis, but I was told by my rheumatologist after my cancer diagnosis that my type of arthritis can actually be triggered by an undiagnosed tumour.
Right.
It's very rare apparently, but, you know.
But they could be connected.
I think, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Very rare, but that's what
you
I was told.
But you are one in a million. So.
Yeah. But anyway, so I've been on high steroid doses for pain, for inflammation. I have quite bad inflammation in my joints, particularly hands and feet. But anyway, so I was on high steroid doses, which made me quite puffy, you know, and that made me, I mean, I was nearly tipping the scales at 100 kgs at one point. They weigh me every fortnight when I go to see the oncologist. Yep. And each fortnight I was going up and up and up. And, you know, we made a bit of a comment about, like a lot of cancer patients actually lose weight, but I was going up. But I looked, I felt like I really looked horrible. You know, I really didn't like how I couldn't fit clothes, and I just sort of felt like I was losing myself.
So uncomfortable in your own body, plus you're not liking what's how you're not feeling good about how you look. There's a lot. There's quite a psychological kind of burden, I think, on top of things, because you know we're all fighting the clock. We're all trying to look better all the time, right?
I mean, you'd look in the mirror and you wouldn't recognise who was looking back at you. You know,
you wouldn't recognise. I guess is the most important thing, right? You know, like for you, you didn't feel like. You felt like yourself.
No. And I just saw kind of like my hair was all frizzy and falling out. My face was all puffy. My eyes looked, I just did not, I mean, it's not a priority when you're fighting cancer, but it just, you're kind of like on top of everything else. It's like, great, now, you know, just it's just where have I gone kind of thing.
Yeah. But that, I think, you say it's not a priority, but I do think it contributes to your overall mood. And, you know, if we've talked a bit about, you know, feeling upbeat and being, you know, that attitude plays so much in terms of the cancer fight. And I think feeling good about how you look, it for, you know, most people is important. So I think it is, you know, impactful on that journey in a way that's maybe not to be underestimated.
A lot of people have commented that my skin looks quite good. And I think when
it
was...
You don't have wrinkles.
When it was puffy, I think everything was getting pushed out.
Well, it filled out? Free filler?
I was joking to people that I was getting embalmed alive, which is like, it was like getting... It's terrible. But it's... Yeah, I have sort of got this weird texture. My skin does have this weird kind of texture.
You mean because it doesn't look... your skin does look great, but are you saying when you feel it, it feels weird?
Well, it just kind of does feel a little bit like pumped out with something.
Plump.
It does feel like.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know. Yeah. I've been blessed with good skin thanks to my mum. But
yes.
I think, you know.
Take that as a win. Keep it. So we've talked about gaining weight, I guess, and losing a bit of hair, but thankfully keeping most of it. What about, because, you know, you were training for an ultramarathon, so you're really active, fit, strong person. And I know you've referenced the fact that actually some days you just basically have to commit to rest as a priority for the day. How hard has that been for you, that idea of being still?
Really challenging because not just mentally but physically, my legs, the muscle has all
like
kind
muscle
of
tone.
Yeah, gone. It's all gone. It's all just sort of quite wasted. You know, I'd walk a lot and bike a lot and it's just my body has, is really weak and wobbly.
It's hard, eh? Because you still have regardless of having awesome support in your life, you're still a mum with young children, and that does come with, like, things need to be done, right? So that must be really difficult for you, because looking after yourself is part of looking after children.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some days, you know, I have to just force myself to get up and do the basics, and then I sit down and have to have a rest. But, you know, I'm on a different course of drugs now, so my body, my joints aren't as sore, so I'm kind of jumping on the fact that I can move my limbs a lot better and I can do stuff. So I've been making it a goal to, you know, exercise is really important.
Yeah.
My oncologist has said at least do 30 minutes a day. So now that I can move around a bit more, I've been trying to go to the pool, and my friend owns a gym in Cromwell, and she's been working on a specific cancer program for me.
Facebook, yeah,
just to sort of help me readjust. It was really emotional going back to the gym. I hadn't been there since before my diagnosis, and I went in wearing scuffs because my feet couldn't fit my shoes, and I didn't realise how hard it would be. And when I got in there and I saw her, like, she's like, hello, Bouncy, hi. And I just burst out in tears. I was sobbing and I couldn't stop, and I'd get ushered to a room, and it was a really hard step for me, and I couldn't believe how...
Hard step in terms of a hard step to get back there, or getting back there was remembering when you could go?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. Yeah. Yep. But I did it, you know, and I sort of got through it. But, you know, even now it's still, I've only been back twice, but.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was difficult. It reminded me of when I was fit and healthy. And
yep.
And she kind of said to me that we have to kind of wipe the slate clean, and you know, I'm coming back and don't have expectations that I'd be going back to what I could
normal,
do.
A new normal. Yeah.
She's like, basically, we've got to start treating, you know, it sounds awful, but treat you like you're an old lady,
yeah,
and you're quite limited on what you, you know, so.
So how do you, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times about, you know, sometimes you're overcome with tears at maybe moments you're not expecting or whatever. And the treatment and fighting cancer and, you know, all the things that happen in your life, the changes to the way you look and feel about yourself, must all contribute to an absolute emotional roller coaster there. And I'm sure your feelings can, you know, turn on a dime, right? So how do you, is that the case? Is it an emotional roller coaster? And how do you manage that? Because that's exhausting too, you know, like that's exhausting too.
Yeah, I do. And, but I think I usually lash out at my parents or partner.
Parents are long-suffering, that's what they all do.
So, and I think that they know that the drugs that I'm on are to blame, and the fact that I'm going through cancer. And, I mean, we all have had breakdowns, and yep, we all just have to be gentle and forgiving on ourselves and understand that actually it's the cancer that's the enemy here, and it's the cancer that's making us a bit crazy sometimes, and we just have to kind of accept that there's going to be moments where we do break down and we do lose it. But the good thing about my family and my partner and even the children, you know, we just, you know, can apologise and, yeah, get back to it.
So, Joe, oncology appointments are now like a regular part of your life. And I can imagine that there's a lot of information. There's a lot going on in that appointment. How long is each appointment? Half an hour?
Yeah, probably.
Half an hour? So so when you go to these appointments, what do you do to, like, either mentally prepare yourself for them, or, you know, how do you cope? Because, I mean, they're difficult conversations, right?
So generally on the drive to the appointment, it's quite good time just to sit and talk to Michael or my stepdad just about things that we want to cover off. And usually we've written a bit of a list about questions that might have cropped up or whatnot. So we kind of go a little bit prepared. Usually I'm focusing on, I wonder what my blood tests have shown with my cancer markers. You've got this number that kind of you fixate on, which is kind of bad.
Is that like the first thing you discuss?
No, he kind of leaves it till the last, but it's the first thing in my mind.
Right, yeah, yeah. I can understand, because it's a hard piece of evidence, right, about how you're going.
Yeah, and he's that can go, at the minute it's the highest it's ever been, so I'm kind of trying to not worry too much about it, but you can't help but worry.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I've gone into the appointment and just not been in the mood and just said, if you don't have anything positive to say to me, please just don't tell me anything. Yeah. And, you know, and the oncologist, you know, he'll be like, well, sometimes, sorry, but you actually have to hear this. Or, you know, or sometimes the news is good. Sometimes the cancer markers have come down and things are looking steady and things are looking good. So, you know. But I always go in there pretty nervous, and my blood pressure is always up, and, you know, I need to kind of be calmed a bit. I'm always a bit manic as well, you know, like quite often we laugh because I sort of talk about everything but the cancer. I sit down and I start
nervous
burbling.
Conversation. Yeah, yeah. Nervous conversation.
Yeah. I start babbling about everything, and I don't know what half the stuff I've said to Chris, but he probably knows way too much about my life because I've just babbled and babbled and babbled because I haven't wanted to hear what he has to say about my cancer. And then we're left with about 5 minutes, and he's like, "Well,
yeah." I think we're both the same in the way that we fill a void in a conversation, you know, like in that respect, right? And so it's kind of like if nothing's been said, we'll just keep talking until something happens.
I definitely recommend writing things out, though. Some people record.
Like audio record, you mean? Right, okay, that's interesting. Because I do think, it's, you, like when you talked about one of your, I think your initial diagnosis conversation where, you know, like you're sitting there and you're feeling in shock and all you've heard is you've got stage 4 cancer, there must have actually been other things discussed, but all you are taking away from that conversation is stage 4 cancer, you know? So recording a conversation seems quite smart.
Yeah, I've never done it, but then my oncologist, he sends me an email after our appointment that has a thorough debrief of what we've discussed and where I'm at. So,
like in case you missed it, catch up.
I always file them in the cancer folder and don't really look at them too much or flick them to Michael and say, "You read it and tell me what I need to know."
Glad to hear you've got good digital admin skills. You've been listening to Joe versus Cancer with Joe McKenzie McLean and me, Colleen O'Hanlon. We know our conversations might be a tough listen, whether you've got cancer or you're caring for somebody who has. There's lots of support available and there's information in the show notes. This is a Stuff podcast produced by Chris Reed. You can listen to the full series at stuff.co.nz or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Kia kaha, be strong.